I do my art as politics. So I will set up a house of 6 working class black females and get them everywhere. That's me responding to the situation at hand. I will set up a platform for the QTPOC community to shine that can get other opportunities. And I try and do it from a joyful and happy place and not sat in that place of kind of languish.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Queer Gaze series 2. I can't believe it's nearly the end of the series already. It's gone so fast. If you're new here, we're a very queer and very arty podcast brought to you by me, Ashley Owen, and Homotopia. Each week, I chat to some of the UK's most loved artists, creatives, and icons about their lives, careers, and views on the arts. This year, we've been sponsored by Northwest Cancer Research to encourage members of the LGBTQIA+ community to be aware of changes in their bodies and to advocate for their health. Northwest Cancer Research lead pioneering research and education that tackle the cause, improve the care, and find a cure for cancer. You can learn more about their life-changing work at nwcr.org. Our guest this week is Darren Pritchard. Darren is a facilitator, producer, choreographer, and former Vogue House mother. He was featured in the BBC documentary Deep in Vogue back in 2020, giving the world an insight into the Vogue ball scene in the UK. Darren is doing amazing work, spreading joy and creating opportunities for queer artists of colour. Hope you enjoy our chat. Darren, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. How are you?
I am good, thank you very much.
Very excited to speak to you. So I always start the podcast with the same few questions. How would you describe who you are and what you do?
I would describe myself as a thinker, a dreamer, a creator, and more importantly, I am somebody who just likes to spread, I know it sounds a bit hippie, but joy, and to be more succinct in that, like queer black joy, and using my experiences as a queer mixed race working man from Manchester to bring joy into the world and do it from that lens. So that's how I would describe myself. And I try to use emotions rather than job titles to describe myself because I'm with my emotions all the time rather than my job. So yeah, it's a journey I'm on now and I have been on the past couple of years is whatever that may be, whatever art form I'm doing, I'm just here to spread joy and queer joy and queer black joy.
That's beautiful. That's such a lovely description because they always say, don't they, that your imprint in the world, people will always remember how you make them feel. And if you've got that so clear in your mind, then that is gorgeous. I love it. So, Darren, what was you like as a little one?
As a little one, if you don't mind my language, I was probably a little bit of a mad ass, to be honest. I'm very close to my mum, so I was very much a mummy's boy. From the age of like 0 to 7, I was ill a lot. What it was is it was with my celiac and they didn't like, now it's a big thing, like everyone's gluten-free and this and that. So like 0 to 7, they was just discovering what that was and it was like the last test that we did. So I was very kind of like needy and clingy and missed a lot of school. So my mum was kind of like my rock and my pillar and stuff. So yeah, so I was very much a mummy's boy. And I was actually very quiet as a child and an observer. And I think I've still got it and it's a trait from my mum, like very empathetic and very kind of like, I'm a very sensitive soul, even though I've got a gob on me when I'm ready to be and I come across as quite strong. Yeah, I was quite quiet and, yeah, I was clinging to my mum.
That's so sweet. Did you always know then that you wanted to be a dance artist and choreographer? Was it always on the cards for you or is it something that unexpectedly happened?
No, I don't think so, because I always loved music and responding to music. And I think as a child growing up in the circumstances that I kind of grew up in, which was very working class background, like dance and music was all around, but you didn't really see it as a career as such, or that it was a pathway that you could take, because my mum couldn't afford to send me to a private dance school or anything. I was always dancing. I think as soon as I heard like the pulse of the music, it just tapped into my heart. I just had to like dance even from a little kid. And that kind of came on, the wanting me to be a dancer kind of came on when I was like 14, 15, because I started off acting at Contact Youth Theatre and we did a play called I Too Speak the Rose, and they had some capoeira in there before it was kind of like even in fashion, like everyone's doing it now. And the youth theatre director seeing that I had something natural for movement, and then she was like, oh, why don't you go and try and do a dance class. And then there was a free contemporary dance class on a Monday in a place called Sheena Simon, and I went there and then I just fell in love with dance and I dropped the acting, and that's when I knew that I wanted to dance. And what was interesting about that is like both Contact and the dance place that I went to were both free as well, and they were kind of like just open, so the financial stuff wasn't a barrier. It was just me getting into the center of town. That's all I needed to do. But yeah, that's when I started to know that I wanted to kind of dance as a career.
How did you discover your queerness and what was coming out like for you?
I've probably always knew that I was queer, and it's people say from a very, very young age. And I was like cliche queer. I mean, I would dress up in my sister's dresses. I would not like I had boys' toys, but I would be drawn to the Barbies. And I remember we'd go to Toy and Hobby and I would walk past every aisle and then I'd just see that row of pink. And then it's like my birthday presents were like, what do you want? I was like, I want a Barbie and a Barbie Ferrari. I went to a Catholic school and they had a boys' playground and a girls' playground. And the boys' playground was situated in front of the girls' one. I used to walk right past the boys' playground and go in the girls' playground. And I was the only boy allowed in there. I wouldn't play football. I refused to play it. And he was like, what do you want to do? And I was like, I want to play netball. Again, I was the only boy in the netball. I wasn't on the team because they didn't allow it then. So I used to play wing attack. And yeah, that's when I found out women weren't the weaker sex, because they were fierce on that court. And so yeah, so I always knew, and I come from a very open background. Like both my godfathers were gay. So it's like I had two gay godfathers. So it was like they were the blueprint for me. So I always knew. I've never dated a woman. I've never kissed a girl. So I'm like on the, well, I call myself the extreme queer. I know what I want. Like it's a lot more like these kids are a lot more fluid and stuff. And it's amazing what they're doing in the revolution of sexuality. But yeah, I always knew. I was the one who got called names at school for acting like a girl, being like a girl, hanging around with the girls and stuff. But yeah, I always knew. And that's why I never dated a girl, because I always knew, even at 14, 15, 16, that I would be doing them a disservice because I had no interest in them at all.
And it sounds like you respected them too much to like break their little heart, you know, by giving them hope.
Yeah. I come from like I come from a single mother and my older sister, so I come from a matriarchy. I have a reverend and a respect for women, and I am a feminist. I know that whether people would allow me to be in that category, and a lot of my friends are lesbians, so I kind of like sit in that female energy and crowd quite easily, and I'm not threatened by a strong woman because I was brought up by two very fierce women. So that was it. I respected them too much to kind of go, look, it was going nowhere with me.
Yeah. A lot of people tend to try and mask their sexualities and they try and play the role of a cishet child at school. What do you think was in you to make you just be your complete, authentic, beautiful self?
Do you know what? I do not know. I really do, because I look back and I was just like, it was like playing in the girls' playground in a Catholic school and them allowing me for one. And I remember I used to run straight through, and then I used to get called the names and this and that. And obviously it hurt, but I just couldn't be any other way. And I think also, again, if you've got two gay godfathers, a mum that's fully accepting, and then I had a quite, what you would call a hard sister, so she would knock anybody out if people got too kind of fresh with me. I never felt the need to kind of hide who I really was. And like coming out for me, I remember it quite distinctly, because I think it was about, because it was quite, I came out quite late, about 16, 17, and I was sat down with my mum downstairs, and like coming out is a big thing for the person, like coming out, and it does revolutionise your life, and it just changed, even though it was my authentic self, like just being open. I remember sat there with my mum, and then I was like, I've got something to tell you. And she's like, what? She goes, I think I'm gay. And she's like, oh yeah, I always knew. Can you help me with the net curtains, please? That was the conversation. And I was kind of dumbfounded, because I was like, this is my big revelation moment. I was like, where's the tears? Where's the big conversation? Where's the kind of like dramatic climax? But it was like very nondescript. And she was like, just as long as you're safe. And then she was like, yeah, can you help me with the net curtains? That was me coming out to my mum. I'll never forget it. But I do remember the relief that I felt, like a weight had been like totally lifted. My sister's reaction, my sister kind of like burst out crying, but it was more like, oh, my brother's come out to me, da, da, da. And then she was with a friend, and then a friend starts questioning me, and then I remember her going, do you like Grant Mitchell? And then my sister's like, will you stop asking these stupid questions? And stuff. And then, yeah, so my mum and my sister were the main ones, because they were my household. They were the people that I had to live with and face every day. So it is so much easier if you're a heterosexual person navigating in this world, and with the intersectionalities as well of me being like the class I come from, and the colour, and certain parts of my white side and my black side, they've both got kind of like homophobic tendencies as well. So it's not the easiest thing to come out, but it was easier for me than most.
Thank you for sharing that. Could you tell us about how you came to be a Vogue dancer and choreographer?
Yeah, it was actually Darren Suarez from Liverpool who taught me how to Vogue. I think he was working for me at the time, teaching. And it's a weird story, but Jason Nevins, that it's like that, it's the way it is. There was a breakdance video, and it brought breakdance right back into fashion. And so I remember talking to Darren, and he's a beautiful Vogue. It just like flows out of him. And I remember saying to him, going, you need to bring Vogue back. I want to learn how to Vogue. I said, all this retro 80s stuff's coming back. And then, yeah, he was the one who kind of like mentored me and schooled me, and then put me into the culture. I've kind of left that now, the Vogue scene behind me now, because what I call, I've had the blessing of like redirection and stuff. But it is a part of my life that has shaped who I am, and that many people, what they know me for in the north and stuff. So yeah, it was Darren Suarez in the House of Suarez. And I was very fortunate, because he's an authentic Voguer who has lived through the experience of that time when Vogue was out. And them being a working class white collective, the House of Andrew Yunus, which he was from Liverpool, could identify with the oppressed queer blacks of New York. Because if you're from Liverpool, and the time that he was gay, it's like, it's hard to be gay in Liverpool now. And you're talking about the 80s and 90s, then they were kind of like pioneers. And he taught me how to be queer and really love being queer. Because I came into queer culture quite late, in terms of like my home. I didn't feel like I needed to search for it and find my tribe, so to speak. Even though I had a few gay friends and I'd go to a gay nightclub, because I had quite a solid home life. So that was quite easy for me. But yeah, that's how I got into it. So I've got Darren Suarez to thank for that, and all the opportunities that were afforded to me afterwards. So yeah, I say he's the seed that made my tree grow in terms of the Vogue stuff.
Beautiful. So I've got obviously a few Vogue questions, but I'm very interested to know what you are doing at the moment, if Vogue is a little bit in the past now. Vogue balls represent so much more than just dance and fabulousness. Could you tell us what they actually represent for artists and for audiences?
For artists, it's a place of expression. People use the term safe space. So it's a safe space where they can be their fully authentic selves. And also their not authentic selves, because you can be anybody you want to be. So if you're a queer working class guy from Liverpool, you can be Dorothy Dandridge, you can be Marilyn Monroe, you can be Beyonce, you can be male, you can be female. And there's categories in the structure in there that allow that to happen. And I think for the audiences, and we've got massive audiences in North, that they're constantly wanting more. And it's to take something that Ricky Beadle Blair says, that the reason why it's so, he thinks it's so big here, is that we really know what it's like to struggle in the North. So whether you're from Liverpool, whether you're from Sheffield, whether you're from Manchester, you are part of a minority, and it's the North, and the opportunities are afforded to you that other places are. So we really know what it's like to struggle, and we put that on stage, and we do it with fierceness and flamboyance and ferociousness. And that's what the audience get. And I think sometimes for the audience, it's a kind of looking at us going, I wish I could be that in my life. I wish I could be as free and as open as them. But sometimes as well, is that ballroom space is the only space that some of the performers can be like that, because then they go back to their jobs, or they're back into their cultures, and they're not out, or they're not fully open. So that's the one space that they can really be like that for that night and be their true superstar selves, which they are, and live that moment of unapologeticness. And the audience feel that. That's why I talk about joy a lot. And, you know, like you said about emotions and feelings, and in, I can only speak for us where we've done and what Darren did. It's like a church. It's like you go out there and you feel something spiritual, and you like, what have I felt? And mainly at his bars, it's love. And you don't feel that on a collective bar, places like church. So it's our sanctuary, and it's our church.
Representation is everything, and to be in a space where so many marginalized people are represented, how could it be anything other than a spiritual experience? Because, you know, that is like true beauty and acceptance, and to have that space where you can take off, you know, whatever hat you have to wear to blend in, and then just be your full authentic self. It must mean so much to the artists involved and the audiences.
Because it's not many times that you can get in the outside world and be celebrated for being queer, full stop, whether you're black, whether you're white, whether you're mute. And then that space where, and especially with the ones here, is that as soon as you hit that stage and the crowd are behind you, that's like validation going, I am in the right place, there is people here. And optics matter. Optics really, really matter. And seeing people that look like you and sound like you and wear clothes like you, it's transformational. Because I've heard many stories and many artists that I really focused on the cutie pop community. And I heard a story the other day that somebody, and we was in a conversation panel, and an artist said that the reason why I started was because I went to Darren's Black Pride Vogue Ball, and I seen a whole load of South Asian artists on that stage living their life. And I was like, I can do this. And that was how their drag character was born. And they're doing their own nights. And I never even knew they'd been doing their own nights and had hired them in as their character. And I really didn't know that. And then it's like, that's one of many stories. Sometimes it's hard being visible like that, because you have to take the knocks as well as the celebrations. But yeah, it is so powerful, the power of optics and seeing yourself on stage. Because it's like in Manchester at the moment, one of my favourite things is that there's a group called the Fuck Pigs, which are, and they do Fat Pride. And there, again, it's like they've gone from like 10 to 20, to, and they're just constantly like growing and stuff. And they just own everything, who they are and what they're about, and their queerness, their size, their shape, and living in their, comfortable in their own skin as well. So it matters to celebrate yourself. I think that's what it does, because there'll be somebody else that is like you and you will inspire. And sometimes you don't even know it. Or like me, 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, people can be going, oh, when I seen and stuff. So yeah, it matters. And that's why I do the work I do.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were featured in the BBC documentary Deep in Vogue in 2020. How was that experience for you? And what sort of reaction have you had from viewers?
We had amazing reactions. We got to go, like, I didn't get to go, but like they flew Ricky over to New York for a premiere of it at a New York festival. It hit all these festivals. It got picked up by the BBC. We got like everything else. We got the love and we got the hate in this world we're in. You get used to it now. But it was a positive experience doing the documentary, and it was a very positive experience for me and my house at that time, and for the girls that were in it, because we set up as a political force within that scene. And I always see, because I'm not one of those that really like pops off on social media or anything like that, I say I do my art as politics. So I will set up a house of 6 working class black females and get them everywhere. That's me responding to the situation at hand. I will set up a platform for the cutie pop community to shine, that can get other opportunities. And I try and do it from a joyful and happy place and not sat in that place of kind of languish, because I realise my privilege, and I realise that I can use the platforms of the people that I've got in a really positive way to kind of like change people's lives, so to speak. But yeah, it was transformational. The documentary was transformational.
Are you still mother of House of Ghetto?
So what we've done now is I've put the House of Ghetto to bed, because we've kind of transformed into... I'm more of like a producer now, a broker. So we changed from House of Ghetto to kind of like Ghetto Fabulous. So we still got the name there. And that's a producing house, which is there to create platforms, create opportunities, create shows. So we've moved on from the bars, which we don't call folk bars. We call catwalk extravaganzas now. We've changed it up a lot in terms of, we've got elements of that, but we've got elements of so much more as well. And stuff, and those catwalk extravaganzas coming from Ghetto Fabulous are cutie pop focused. And yeah, and it allows me to work with many more artists as well. So I've moved to working with like rappers and circus artists and singers, so I can put on cabaret shows and I can invite them to the extravaganzas, because the Vogue culture is a very set culture from a long line and legacy, which you have to kind of like respect and revere. So I've respected it enough to go, actually, I am not that. I've been called out for it as well, and I'm like, I hold my hands up, we're not that no more. And if I've needed to change the label, but I think what I'm doing now is totally and 100% me, and it's what I'm about. And I can create my own rules, I can create my own regulations, and I can create my own little universe of safety, because the community that I work within and I absolutely love, it's a beautiful and nuanced community, but it's also underlaid with fragility as well. And there's lots of people with different mental health issues, and there's different people with different access needs. And it's like, I'm trying to create a space that represents all of that at the moment. And I've needed that blessing of redirection to go, I can take the best bits of what I've done in the past, and then I can move forward and kind of like create something new. And yeah, and just see spaces of kind of like cutie pop joy that we can all enjoy and come into, because I've done two extravaganzas now, and then we just did our first one in Sheffield as well. That wasn't fully cutie pop, run by Andrew and Eve, which was just as beautiful as the rest of them as well. So yeah, that's a space that I'm in. I kind of say like I'm a joy Nazi. I'm like, you're not joyful, go away, I can't take these negative. Because I think after the pandemic, after all that we've been through, life is very precious. It's very short. We're not here for a long time in the bigger scale of the universe. And anything can happen at any time, where our liberties and our freedom. We look what's happening in the Ukraine. We look what's happening in some of the world. I look at my LGBT pushes, even in Russia, what's happening to them in their own land. And it's like, why wouldn't we in here in the UK with them? People don't like saying it, but we have got certain privileges. like, doing this podcast is a privilege. You know, you can put it out there and you're not going to get shut down by the government.
Yeah.
And stuff. So why in this time that we've got, why not create as much beauty and joy and interconnectivity that we can? I do through the kind of like the Black Queer Joy, and people love to see it because they don't, like, our audiences are as much white as they are kind of like, we get a very good mix as our kind of Black and Brown brothers and sisters, but people love seeing that diversity. They love it when they come to the event because they're like, we just don't see this, and we just, and it's that they don't see that many en masse. You'll see the one or the two, but it's different when there's a collective of 30 Black and Brown people just really being themselves, and they bring in their culture and their spirituality and the way they dress and the music that they choose. It's just not seen.
I think it's totally valid to, as people, we grow in life and we try different things, and I think to take inspiration of what you've been doing and then sort of like use that to move and grow, I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, because nothing's new, like,
exactly.
Nothing's new, and then everyone's kind of like reinventing. I suppose I grew up with lots of pioneers, you know, you've got your Princes and your David Bowies and your Madonnas at the first half, and everything nowadays is a remix or a rehash or a reversion of. And that's what I say with Girl Fabulous, with the performers. I said, I want to be the springboard that you springboard from. I don't want to keep you here. I said, and I'm at the point where I can't actually afford some of the artists that I gave my first gigs to, but I'm not about to beg them for that price, because it's like, no, this is what you're worth now. I can't afford you, but do you know what? I had you at that time when I could. And I'm like, yes. Yes, I was like, because that's what we're here for. And there's been many artists like that we've given their first gigs and they've gone on to do amazing stuff. And that's what life should be about. It's like I use a Sankofa principle a lot, which is like, it's from West Africa, and it's a principle of a bird that's always looking back but moving forward. And he's got an egg in the mouth, which is the genius of what has gone before to move him forward. And so I use that a lot in my life of going, look where you've come from and look where you're doing it. Because I'm like, probably Grace Jones has done it before. And it's like, and that's when you can pay homage, and then you can go, well, actually, there's some innovative stuff in the catwalk stuff I do. There's some borrowed stuff. There's some, but it's like, we're all interconnected as human beings, and nothing is new. So
yeah, there's a famous quote about that, isn't there? It's something like, art is either plagiarism or revolution.
I've not heard that, but that I'm taking that. Yeah, it is. And it can be sometimes a plagiarism that creates a revolution, because you can be doing that old thing and then you're like, actually, I've done the old thing, now how do I make it my own, how do I put that twist on it, and stuff. But yeah, I like that play. Yeah.
You can have that. Not that I could come up with that. Do you have a career highlight so far, Darren?
My God, career highlight so far. Do you know what? There's a few, and I'll just list a few. Like, getting to tour the UK and Europe with my mum in a show called Susan and Darren was like one of the most magical and spectacular things that not many people in this world can say that they have ever done. Doing the catwalk extravaganzas, doing them and how well they have been taking off, that's a career highlight for me. I recently got to go to Edinburgh with a group of working class artists with Rent Party, and it was the first time that some of them had even been to Edinburgh. One artist didn't even know where Edinburgh was. So yeah, so stuff like that. There's so many, but they're the ones that I can think of off the top of my head.
What sort of work would you like to go on to do in the future?
I'm now at a stage where I've kind of lost the joy of performing, so that holds no real interest for me. Theatre, I've done a lot of, but I'm probably going to take a break from creating a theatre work, so to speak, such as like Rent Party or Susan and Darren. And I just want to make the work that I'm doing now, like the catwalk extravaganza stuff, that I find real joy in doing that. I found the joy of facilitation and creative producing. And Like, I like my WhatsApp groups with 20 artists. It's like, we're getting the coach here and we're doing this and we're doing that. And they get all that producer anxiety and this and that. But I absolutely love doing that. And then my boys are out every weekend dancing and people are like, are you dancing? And I was like, no, I actually love that I get to give them this platform. I'm like a pushy stage school mum and I absolutely love it. Like, producing and facilitating and creating platforms for other people to kind of like shine and bounce up onto. So yeah, that's where I'm really finding like my, because put me on stage and I'm just like, I'm very nonchalant. I could eat a kebab before I went on stage and be still thinking about the kebab that I've left on the side at the stage, which I recently did, and I was just kind of like, this is where you need to tap out now and pass it on, because I've not got that joy or the rush of the audience appreciation. But I do enjoy putting on events where people do get to like just be themselves.
Yeah. Whose work are you inspired by or particularly loving at the minute?
There's ethoses of companies that I like. Like, I absolutely love who I just worked with on Rent Party, which is Commonwealth Theatre Company. I've had a relationship with the one in Wales, and then Commonwealth is all about promoting working class artists, and that's why it's got Common in the title, and Wealth is what they distribute and what I put out into the world. So I love their ethos and their work and their principle and their care of artists and their artist focus. So I really kind of love them. But I've not been out to see a lot of work at the moment, because do you know when you're in the arts, the last thing I want to do is like, because I'm producing and I'm creating, it's like, I just want to go home and I just want to watch Netflix. I just want to watch something mind numbing. Or I go and see like a big show, like a musical where I can just switch off and like, it just washes over me and I'm not kind of like, I like festivals like Homotopia. So again, ideologies. I love the work that they've been doing, because I actually wouldn't be where I am at the moment without like Gary and then Shah believing in me and my work. Always, every time I've had a piece, they've booked it or I've gone to them, it's a very open conversation. There's Curious Festival in Newcastle, Phil, another queer is. So I'm loving people in the arts more than the work. I've just realised that they're actually people in really hard places to create the work that they're creating. I've only just, because you've got Newcastle, Liverpool and like Wales, they're not like hotbeds of arts and activity. Like, I'm spotting Manchester, and they're carving and creating an audience and a niche and opportunities for people. And there may be many more that I'm missing off, but yeah, they're the people that I'm loving at the moment. And these grassroots organisations, like, I absolutely adore. They're taking time out, like House of Noir, Rainbow Noir, who they went into House Noir, who have done tremendous work with the QTPOC community, which has allowed me to slip into that community very easily and find a whole network of people and stuff. So, yeah, I'm loving people in the arts more than the work that people are creating at the moment, because I think that's who I connect with more than going to see a load of work.
Absolutely. I'm the same as you. Like, when I'm not working, I just want to like zone out and watch Netflix, and I don't want to be reminded of like all the projects or what's next. Yes. Or like, oh, I should be doing this. I want to watch The Real Housewives just bitch about each other.
Oh my God, yeah. That's why I'm not dating an artist. When people are like, I'm like, I'm dating a handyman. So I can go home and he's like, babes, grass seed, weed killer. Oh, they're the conversation. I don't want to be coming home and being like, what did you think of that work? Was it interesting? Where do you think it sits within the arts? What do you think that all that stuff is? Because I'm in it and producing. It's like, yeah, it's the last thing that I do. But there is some beautiful people within the arts that I've been very blessed to work with and work alongside.
Okay, Darren, so this is my last question. I've actually got so many more, but I'm trying to be disciplined and I need to make a 40-minute episode. It could be 5 hours.
Yes.
But I know you're very busy as well. What is the most useful piece of advice that you could give to emerging queer artists?
One would be stick to your guns, because you're going to get lots of advice. You're going to get some that is wanted, not wanted. So stick to your guns, yeah. Be as authentic as possible in your work. And not everybody's going to, I say, not everyone's going to like what you're going to do. And sometimes you'll do work where 5,000 people love it. And sometimes you'll do work where 5 people love it. But if those 5 people, it makes a change in their life, then you've done your job as an artist. You have to stay the course and be disciplined. And I always say it to my, to the cutie pop artists, is that unfortunately, that sometimes to be queer or to be black, you have to be better and work that slightly bit harder. Because what happens is you start measuring yourself against the stick of your kind of counterparts of straightness and whiteness or thing, and it's not a level playing field. So it is going to be harder being a woman in the arts. So you have to work that little bit harder. And I wish we was in a world where we wasn't like that, because I like to be very real, and I'm like, it's going to be hard work, and it's hard work for me now. It's like, but you have to stay the course, and you have to believe in what you believe in, and that your voice is valid. And your voice, does somebody, if it's 1-2 people that hear your voice and it affects them, then so be it. Your job as an artist is done. That's all you need to do. You only need to change one heart and mind of somebody that sees your work. And also, don't watch other people. Stay in your lane, because what you're constantly be doing, you'll start comparing, you'll start contrasting. What's meant for you is meant for you, and what's not won't pass you by. So that's a kind of few, because I couldn't sum it up in one in one little snapshot. And you've got people to now, especially Jesus, we've got a gay bloody Doctor Who and a trans bloody, like Yasmin as his thingy, and then you've got It's a Sin, and you've got all these. Got Drag Race on TV and Pose, and you've got like not just queerness but blended gender fuck queerness, which I'm absolutely living for. So you're in a very, very exciting time. Yeah, I think just stay true to yourself.
Darren, thank you so much for chatting with me today. It's been so lovely. You are incredible and so inspiring, so thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, that's very sweet.
What a treat. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If this was your first one, you can go back to previous chats with Alex Ogden Clark, Tabby Lamb, Tom Marshman, VJ Patel, and Sue Tilly. And of course, there is the whole of series one to enjoy. If you've had fun listening, please leave us a review and rating and share this episode with all of your friends. This has been The Queer Gaze, hosted and produced by me, Ashley Owen. A big, big thank you to Homotopia for their support, especially the amazing Olivia. Thanks to Lotieni for the artwork and to our sponsors at Northwest Cancer Research. Maybe we'll see you again. Bye!